This copyrighted audio file from the writings of David S. Lample is offered free of charge to the glory of God the Father and the praise of Jesus Christ our Lord. Detailed copyright and resource information is included at the end of this file.
First Things, a study of Genesis 1 to 11. Session 62, Getting Things in Order. Genesis 11, verses 1 to 9. This session first published March 2, 2025. Over the last few weeks, we have laboriously worked our way through chapter 10, with its many lists of Noah's descendants. We have systematically considered the distribution of families after the flood, but we have paid scant attention to time. That is, when did all this distribution of families take place? So to approach this epical moment in the history of man that we find in chapter 11, the distribution of languages, we must back up just a little and find its place and time in antiquity. Not unlike the composition of its brother, the Revelation, the composition of Genesis does not follow a strict chronological path in its narrative. One passage might overlap another, or even predate an earlier passage, or postdate one coming after. Ancient writers did not always compose their narratives in a strictly linear fashion, one to which we are more accustomed. This does not represent inaccuracy, it's just a different way to compile the various pieces of history, a different way of thinking of history. While not inaccurate, it can present a challenge for us in interpreting the larger picture. So let's see if we can work out the chronological placement of chapter 11 in relation to chapter 10. Coming after chapter 10, we immediately assume that the story related in chapter 11 occurred after the dispersal of Noah's descendants in chapter 10. But that is not the case. Leupold makes two statements that, at least initially, gave me pause. First, quote, "The time of this event," that is the erection of the Tower of Babel, "is about 100 years after the flood, since Peleg was born 100 years after the flood," end quote. Second, quote, "It must be recalled that practically the whole human race participated in this project," that is the building of the tower, end quote. Let's look at these statements in turn, but we must combine our conclusions for each to determine the chronology of these two chapters. Let's begin by looking at the statement about Peleg. As I pointed out in our previous session, an important division occurs in the two sons of Eber, Peleg and Yoktan. Through Peleg will come Abraham. Through Yoktan, Babylon. I found it interesting that in chapter 10, Moses does not include the line out of Peleg, even though he is the most important branch, yet includes a long list of Yoktan's sons. Salehammer helped clarify this for me, which also helps us understand how the two chapters work together. We'll look at that in a moment. According to the list in chapter 11, verses 10 to 26, we see that the arithmetic confirms Leupold's first statement. And by the way, to ensure that the calculations were accurate, I asked my good wife Linda to do the arithmetic for me. I am words, Linda is numbers. So look at Genesis 11, verse 10. These are the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and became the father of Arpakshad, 2 years after the flood. Okay, we looked at this before. Working through the subsequent years for each generation, we come up with Peleg being born 101 years after the flood. Why is this important for our understanding of the Babel narrative? Leupold makes the logical conclusion that the division in 1025 refers to the division and disbursement of 11 verses 7 to 9. Let's look at that. Genesis 10, verse 25. Now two sons were born to Eber. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. And his brother's name was Yoktan. Okay, now, Genesis 11, verses 7 to 9. This is Yahweh speaking. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, so that they will not understand one another's language. So Yahweh scattered them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there Yahweh confused the language of the whole earth, and from there Yahweh scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So, looking solely at the chronology, the dating of this, so to speak, although we cannot assign a year and month, the conclusion is that the events chronicled in Genesis 11, verses 1 to 9, occurred about 100 years after the flood. Is that sufficient time for the various families to populate the earth as seen in the map we have been using? In other words, if we are to take the order of chapters 10 and 11 in chronological order, that's 10 occurred first and events of 11 occurred second, is that sufficient time, 101 years, for the various families to populate the earth as seen in the map we've been using? I think not. Is it sufficient time for the sons of Noah to migrate from Ararat to the Shinar region and begin building the city that would become Babylon? Yes, indeed. As to Leupold's second statement, it makes sense if we agree with the first. It is estimated by people smarter than I that in those 100 years, the population of the earth would have grown to about 30,000 persons. Certainly enough to found a city, and sufficient to begin construction of a tower, but insufficient to populate the coverage we see in the map we've been using for the last few weeks. I want to return to chapter 10, verse 10, and Nimrod for just a moment. Let's read verses 10 and 11 again. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, in the land of Shinar. From that land he went out to Assyria and built Nineveh and Rehoboth-ur and Calah. In session 60 I said this, here is the first empire and it begins with Babel / Babylon. Same thing. We may deduce from the text, since verse 11 says that Nimrod built Nineveh, he may not have literally built Babel, but just conquered an existing city and made it his own. End quote. We don't know the age of Nimrod, only that he was a grandson of Ham. His name is set apart from his five listed brothers, probably because of the larger impact he had on civilization. But we don't know if he was an older or younger brother. It could very well be that Nimrod conquered the city that had been founded by the line from Shem through Arpakshad, Eber, and Peleg. Now, one more look at verse 25 in chapter 10. Now two sons were born to Eber. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. And his brother's name was Joktan. Verse 30 tells us that this line's settlement extended from Meshah as you go towards Sephar, the hill country of the east. This is followed in verse 2 of chapter 11 with, "And it happened as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there." Here's that quote from Salehammer. Verse 30 gives us the location of the settlement of the Joktan line, but narratively, it serves to connect the line of Joktan with the account of the building of Babylon that follows in 11:4. The link is made by means of the key term, quote, "mountains of the east," or "hill country of the east." Salehammer continues, "The narrative is less interested in the exact location than it is in the association with the eastward of 11:2, the location of the plain of Shinar, where the city of Babylon was built." Now here once again we have two different translations with which to contend. The LSB, NASB, and NIVs have in 11:2, quote, "they journeyed east," or eastward. The ESV and King James versions have, quote, "from the east." One is to the east, one is from the east. Each translation of the Hebrew can be grammatically correct. So these are not bad translations, either one of them. But the context of this passage, along with translations of the same in earlier passages in Genesis, for example, chapter 3, verse 24, chapter 4, verse 16, would seem to make eastward correct here, to the east. And both Leupold and Salehammer agree that it should be eastward, that is, to the east, not from the east. As we can see from the map, Shinar, from Ararat, is actually more south than anything else, but is also just slightly southeast. In addition to the grammar, consistently in Genesis, when man goes east, he leaves the land of blessing and goes to a land where the greatest hopes will turn to ruin. In other words, in so many settings in Genesis, heading east is not a reward, it's punishment. One more piece of evidence. How does chapter 10 end? "These are the families of the sons of Noah according to their generations by their nations. And out of these the nations were separated on the earth after the flood." In verse 25, Peleg's name means division, a noun. In this verse, verse 32, the word translated separated or spread out means divided, parad, a verb. Now, after examining all this minutiae, let's now put this all together into a narrative form so we can better understand it. After a little over a year of the inundation, the ark comes to rest on a mountain in the Ararat region. The family of Eight disembarks. Shem is the oldest son of Noah at 98. Chapter 11, verse 10. And Noah is about 601 years old. Chapter 7, verse 6. We do not know how long the three sons and their immediate families remained in the Ararat region. But approximately 100 years later, we find all of Noah's descendants in the region of Shinar. We get this time span by counting the generations from Arpakshad, probably not Shem's oldest son, to Peleg. Chapter 11, verses 10 to 17. Quote, "For in his days the earth was divided." Chapter 10, verse 25. And all, of course, speaking the same language. This would mean that the various branches of the family did not disperse across the globe from Ararat, but from Babel/Babylon. And frankly, if one looks at the map, Shinar presents a far more central location than Ararat for the eventual distribution of the descendants. Now we're ready to dig into chapter 11. Let's read the first four verses. "Now the whole earth had the same language and the same words. And it happened as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. Then they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they had brick for stone, and they had tar for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth.'" Let's begin with a very good summary quotation from H.C. Leupold. He writes this, "If, then, the account as a whole shows the confusion of tongues to be the outgrowth of human presumption and disobedience, the practical lesson of the story must be primarily this, that the present resultant confusion that is upon us must serve as a constant reminder of the inclination of the human heart to arrogance and disobedience. The multiplicity of languages upon the face of the earth is a monument, not to human ingenuity, but to human sin." That's good. That's Leupold. Verse 1. "Now the whole earth had the same language and the same words." That may seem redundant to most of us, but it's not. Before we can understand the change that will occur at the command of Yahweh, we need to understand what was in place prior to that. The word translated language is safa, meaning literally lip. This may be a reference to dialect or sound, expressing that, for example, quote, "the lips of all were shaped alike in uttering words," end quote. The word translated words or speech is dabar in the plural, dabarim. And I think is best understood to mean vocabulary. All used the same words and sounded the same to express a thought. Now, verse 2. "And it happened as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there." Now, I admit, this business of east or west in this passage is slippery. From the end of 10 to this verse here. Perhaps 10:30 is more critical to this than we might originally think. Look back at that. "Now their settlement extended from Meshah as you go towards Sephar, the hill country of the east." The emphasis there seems to be more about location than direction. The hill country of the east. For example, if we live somewhere in North America and we intend to visit a friend who lives in South Korea. This means we will be traveling to the Far East. If we travel west to Europe first, to visit another friend in France, before continuing on to South Korea, we have traveled in a westerly direction, but our ultimate destination is to the Far East. That is why I believe verse 30 in chapter 10 is saying, essentially, the sons of Yoktan settled in the hill country of the east. The hill country of the east. Or, the hill country in the Far East. We must also admit that, in contrast, verse 11, verse 2, seemingly speaks of direction rather than location. Although one might also stretch it to read as if it fits our above illustration. But that may be a bridge too far. At the same time, however, if the King James versions and the ESV are correct, from the east, that is, traveling from the east in a westerly direction, then we must ask, well, precisely from where then? What was east? Where were they east of Shinar to travel west to get there? We don't really have an answer for that. Ultimately, the question of direction must give way to geography. The ark landed in Ararat, and the people migrated from there to the plain of Shinar, period. Whatever the compass says in either of these locations, that's the geographical story. From Ararat to Shinar. Verse 2 ends, and settled there. If one goes to Iraq today, one might wonder what about this region could have possibly attracted these people to it. Except for the areas near the two rivers, it's little more than barren desert. Today's Baghdad is on the Tigris rather than the Euphrates, but it's the same general area. But we forget that area has not always looked as it does today. This area would have been inviting, being far more fertile than it is today. Now, verse 3. Then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and they had tar for mortar. Mud brick was, and remains, a common building material in the Middle East. I remember when we were in Egypt in the early 80s, driving past a miserable hovel near the side of the road made of mud brick, or perhaps even just dried mud. It looked like a pile of mud with a door in the middle of it, still occupied by a family. Mud bricks would typically have been sun-dried, and did last for surprisingly considerable periods in a region with little rain. In fact, Linda and I saw ruins of walls still standing in some temple precincts in Egypt, constructed from unfired mud bricks. The bricks mentioned in verse 3, however, are not sun-dried, but kiln-dried, burned thoroughly. The text is literally, quote, let us burn to a burning, end quote, which everyone interprets to mean bake them thoroughly, as the New King James Version has it. So these would be more akin to modern bricks, sufficiently hardened to be used for substantial construction. Unlike the immediate Mediterranean area, such as Canaan, Greece, Crete, or Cyprus, there was not sufficient stone for construction, hence the need for bricks. They had to make stones. Lacking also the material for mortar, they again used what was available, bitumen, or tar, natural tar. Speaking of making bricks when no stone is available, some people might be surprised to learn that there are portions of the great pyramids in Egypt, especially that of Khufu, the Great Pyramid, which were formed of concrete. They would use concrete back then, and there were places where instead of a natural stone cut to shape, they would use concrete. Now verse 4. And they said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth." Now we're treading on this lightly. We will return to it when we come back for motives, for purposes, for the motives of a holy God against these people. We'll look at those when we return in our next session. But right now we're just treading lightly on the actions and the materials. With these materials, they built a city and began work on a central tower, a ziggurat, a temple dedicated for worship to the local god. This would not be a pyramid in the Egyptian 4th dynasty fashion or design. Those pyramids, those three large pyramids with smaller pyramids near them, from the 4th dynasty that people see in the area of the Giza Plateau in Egypt. It would not be those, but somewhat similar to the design of the very first pyramid in Egypt for the 3rd dynasty king Djoser, circa 2686 to 2613 BC. That would be a stepped pyramid. The first pyramid in Egypt was a stepped pyramid, but those were fairly regular steps, whereas a ziggurat was not regular. It was not meant to be a pyramid. The Egyptian pyramids were only elaborate and massive tombs, mostly solid, except for secret passageways and a secret escape for the king's ka, his spirit, to escape. But the ziggurat would be a majestic place of worship, not a tomb, but a temple. Now, in our next session, we will finish our look at the first 9 verses of chapter 11 and complete our study of the first things.
Thank you for using our Bible study resources. This has been the audio version of our weekly printed session notes. It is copyright 2024 by David S. Lample, but is offered free of charge and may be freely shared with others. All printed and audio notes are available in the Bible study section of our website at dlample.com. This website also includes our monthly devotional, Reflections by the Pond, as well as archives of our devotional publications from the last 34 years. You will also find at dlample.com all of our His Company Christian drama resources. Unless otherwise indicated, scripture in this audio file is from the Legacy Standard Bible, copyright the Lockman Foundation. Greek and Hebrew citations and definitions are from Strong's Greek and Hebrew Dictionary and the NASB Greek Hebrew Dictionary. All resources are offered free of charge in acknowledgement of the Lordship of Jesus Christ. For more information about who we are, please visit the About Us page at our website.